We're going to be in Daniel chapter 11 this morning. And if you're visiting with us, looks like we have several visitors. It's exciting to have such a full class. We've been studying through the book of Daniel over the past 3 months or so. And we're kind of in the home stretch here in the last two chapters of Daniel. And last week we covered chapter 10. And I'm not sure why I thought that I could cover chapter 10 and get into part of 11, but that's what I thought. And as you know, we didn't do that. We spent the whole class on chapter 10. It was one of my favorite class sessions that we've had in this study so far. And I really have gotten a lot out of this. I hope you have too. As a quick review of chapter 10, we discussed last week that these last three chapters of Daniel can sort of be studied as a unit. This is the last vision of Daniel that we're going to read this morning, but there was a prelude to it in chapter 10. We read how Daniel had an angelic visitor that came and spoke to him about some of the difficult things for us to understand, frankly, the spiritual battles and the spiritual struggles that go on in places that are invisible to us, and maybe how those things manifest themselves in the physical world. But we saw that Daniel had been praying for about 3 weeks in chapter 10, that he had been fasting. And after reading through the chapter, it seems like he was doing that because he wanted understanding. And we've finished studying his whole life just about, at least the parts of it that he's decided to write down for us, and we've seen that prayer and devotion to God have often resulted in greater understanding for Daniel. And so he has devoted himself to this, and we see that this angelic figure comes and visits him in chapter 10. And what does the angel tell him right off the bat? Man greatly loved, man highly esteemed, your version might say. What else does he say?
Did God heard your prayer from the very beginning?
Absolutely. He says, your prayer was heard from the very beginning that you started uttering it. It was heard, and not only was it heard, but an answer was dispatched to Daniel. And then what? The next part's really interesting, right? Yeah, there was a delay. This angelic visitor tells Daniel that he was detained. He was struggling with a prince of another nation, the prince of Persia. And so we really begin to struggle with that a little bit at that point in chapter 10. And we're given a glimpse, as this angel wraps up his message, we're given a glimpse of how these struggles that are going on in spiritual places, heavenly realms, can affect real-world events. And in some cases, it seems like some of the nations that are pieces on the chessboard of the world, if you will, have their own champions and their own representatives in these spiritual places. And at the very end of this chapter that we studied last week, it seems that this visitor that came to talk to Daniel stands almost alone in his representing the people of God in these spiritual wars. But he has a helper, and that helper is Michael. Very difficult, very challenging concepts to wrestle with, but you know, I hope some of the analogies that we talked about last week, how there are forces that we know of, that science has taught us about, that we can't see, but they have the power to move things that we can see. Maybe that helps us understand a little bit what might be taking place here, that there are powers that we can't see, but we're told in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that those powers are part of our spiritual struggle. They're part of the spiritual battle that's going on that you and I have a role to play within. So we know those powers still exist today because of the writings of Paul. We know they existed in Daniel's time. And that's just one more way that I feel like I have a connection to Daniel. Even though I didn't live in his time, I didn't receive these messages, and I've never been visited by an angel. I know that Daniel was a man of prayer. Daniel was a man of God. And he had a role to play in the spiritual battle that's going on around us. And we can say all of those things for everybody sitting in this room. So as we continue this study this morning, consider your connection and your kinship to Daniel as a child of God. We're going to read through chapter 11 this morning. And by way of introduction to this chapter, most of this chapter is not really that controversial, as far as I understand it, which is a nice change of pace, right? Jerry's like, thank you. But we're going to get through probably two-thirds of this chapter, and there's general agreement on a lot of it because of how detailed it is. There are various perspectives on maybe the last third of it that we'll talk about towards the end. But it's a very, very specific, detailed series of prophecy. And if you remember the angel's overall message in chapter 10, if you kind of zoom up and take a high-level look at that message, what it's saying is there's a time or a season of darkness that's coming for God's people. And there are forces that are going to ally themselves against God's people. And there are going to be wars and desolations. Those are already determined. But it's temporary, like a lot of the other messages that have been delivered to Daniel. There's a lot of bad stuff coming, but it's temporary and it has a predetermined end. God has already decided that this isn't going to be permanent. And I want to review this chapter the way we do other prophecies that are this detailed. And there aren't too many of those. But if you think about Isaiah 53 and some passages prior to that chapter that talk about the so-called suffering servant of Isaiah, we're given a very detailed character profile of Jesus, right? And you can read those. If you're not familiar with Isaiah 53, please take some time today to read it. I think you'll be struck by just how quickly you begin to identify the suffering servant as Jesus. And I want to use sort of the same forensic, if you will, approach to identifying some of the figures in this chapter 11 of Daniel that we saw people using 3 years ago when we all studied evidences. I know a lot of people in here weren't in that class. And if you weren't, I'll give you just a brief background so that we can all be on the same page. But a few years ago, here at Woodland Hills, we went through a semester-long study of Christian evidences. And we spent several weeks in the scientific evidences, right? Maybe some philosophical evidences. We started with a hypothetical person who might not have any worldview or faith or religious sway one way or the other, who might ask questions like, where did everything come from? Did all of this just happen, or was it created? Assuming the conclusion is there was a creator, which is the conclusion we come to in the class, who is that creator? Does he want to talk to us? Has he tried to communicate with the people he's made? And does he seek a relationship with us? And once that question is answered, we move into, is this God's word? Is this the way that he's chosen to communicate with us? And somewhere along that way, I don't remember exactly where in the class it was, we asked the question, can we trust the Bible? And who was Jesus? And are these prophecies true? And we spent a whole class, almost, on Isaiah 53. And if you were in that class, you might remember a video I showed where there was a professor at a Bible Institute here in America. It might have been the Moody Bible Institute, but he was a converted Jew who came to Christ. And he did this test where he worked in his office, where he took Isaiah 53 and he stripped it of its biblical context as far as verses and chapters. And he just printed the text on a page and he started handing it out to people where he worked. And he said, I want you to read this, and when you're done, tell me, who do you think this is? And person after person was saying, well, it's obviously Jesus. He said, okay, well, when do you think that was written? Well, maybe, you know, sometime after Christ, you know, first, second century, maybe sometime after Jesus lived. And he says, no, it wasn't. It was written 1,000 years before Jesus lived on the earth. It's part of the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery. It's been dated by numerous scholars. Isn't it amazing that somebody could write something like that, that is so accurately a description of Jesus 1,000 years before he lived? Remember that test that we used for those who were in that class? I'm seeing a few nods. I don't know if everybody remembers that, but I'd like to use that same method today as we look through this chapter 11. Because in chapter 11, we're going to get tons and tons of detail about kings and nations and wars. And it'll be difficult compared to reviewing Isaiah 53 because most of us, I think, sitting here this morning have a lot of knowledge already up here about who Jesus is and the life that he lived. And so that knowledge is already in our heads, and we can read Isaiah 53, and we can immediately start to make that connection. But unless you have a very detailed historical knowledge of everything that happened from about the 6th century to the BC to the 1st century AD, those connections aren't just going to start popping as we read Daniel chapter 11. But there's a lot of information available that I'm going to try to condense so that we can make some of those connections. So I hope that this is a fruitful study. Let's go ahead and read the first 8 verses or so of Daniel chapter 11. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out towards the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. I want to pause there for just a second, okay? This is a slide that I dug up from my materials in the evidences class a few years ago. I've only read four verses so far, but you can see the detail that's coming out at us and how it might be similar to the approach we took for Isaiah 53. We walked through Isaiah here. We actually started in 42. But you can see the kinds of details I have up here. Elected by God, anointed by the Spirit, he will bring ultimate justice. Skip down to 49 verse 2 of Isaiah. He is a gifted teacher. He will be discouraged at times. The Gentiles will receive his ministry. 53 verse 3, he experiences pain and affliction. He suffers on behalf of his people. Those are the kinds of details I was referring to a moment ago in our study of Isaiah 53. These are very specific descriptors of not just a person, but the life that he lived and the things that are going to happen. And already we're seeing those same kinds of details here in this prophecy that Daniel is relating to us in chapter 11. So that's the kind of comparison I'm talking about. These are really, really detailed prophecies. And it's also part of the reason why skeptics look at Daniel and they say there's no way that that's really prophecy. Why? Why did we say that they are so skeptical? It's too accurate. So if you start the conversation by ruling out the possibility that something can be prophetic, then details that are accurate are a problem. But if you leave your mind open to the fact that God might actually be communicating to the people that love him, it sort of becomes a faith-building experience. Dwayne.
Those are the same people that you take Nostradamus and figure out precisely what he was talking about.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Nostradamus is, if you've read any Nostradamus, I'm sorry. But it's very open to interpretation. So I'll continue. I think I read verse 4, but I'll read verse 4 again. But as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes. He will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His domain will be a great dominion indeed. For some years they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power. But she will be given up, along with those who brought her in, and the one who sired her as well as he who supported her in those times. But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. Also their gods, with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, he will take into captivity to Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. So everybody at this point has a clear idea of who we're talking about, right?
Sure.
Right. This really begins a lengthy section that is going to sound just like these first eight verses. It's very detailed. There's a lot of, this person is going to do this, and this guy is going to come to power, and he's going to do this, and then lots of details and lots of descriptors of mostly of what's happening and not as much about who these people are. But we're seeing the beginnings of a saga here in these first eight verses that's going to carry on through almost half of the chapter. There are three more kings in Persia, though, to kind of give us a starting point from where Daniel's at. There's going to be four more kings. Depends on whether you want to include the first one. We don't know a lot about the ones in between, but we're told some details about the fourth king. What are some details that jumped out at you in the beginning of that passage I just read about the fourth king? He's going to be very wealthy. Okay. So we know he's going to be really wealthy. We know that he's going to be aggressive towards the nation of Greece. Okay, so already we've got one connection, right? That reminds you of Xerxes who burned Athens.
But as soon as he reaches his height of power,
okay. Based on which verse? Okay, good question. I think it's a different king, and I'll tell you why in just a second. Well, we can go ahead and get into it. I think in verse 3 where it says, a mighty king will arise, this is a king that follows after the fourth king, and it's that king that seems to rule for a very short period of time before his kingdom is parceled out into four different pieces. That's kind of my reading of it. But it's quick. It's a fast-paced prophecy. And I don't know if Daniel has ever gotten one this vivid before. And part of the reason I say that is because of the reaction that he had to it. I tend to think that in verse 10, he's fasting and praying because he wants understanding of this vision. In chapter 11, he's getting around to writing it down for us to study. But you think back to the previous visions he's had, the vision of the statue. Well, that wasn't even Daniel's vision. That was Nebuchadnezzar's vision. But he's interpreting it, and he's contemplating it. And then there's the writing on the wall, the vision of the ram and the goat. A lot of figurative, symbolic characters in those visions. But this is almost like a battle plan. This is almost like a script. I kind of wonder if that's really what it is. If he's being given such detail because it was given to him by one of those spiritual warriors that's acting in heavenly places that we're not really familiar with.
Every once in a while, I think it's interesting that it throws in a country every once in a while. You know, they'll say Persia, Greece, but then they'll say the north and the south, and you're not really sure.
Right.
And then it throws in Egypt, you know, where, you know, specific hard facts, and then there's vague facts.
Yep. If you didn't hear Alan's comment, he was just pointing out that there's kind of a blend of really specific pieces of information in this prophecy, and ones that aren't specific at all, at least not named. You've got names and you've got descriptions. Here's my take on these kings. I think this fourth king, if you're counting from Cyrus, is Xerxes, like Brian pointed out. There's a lot going for that view that this fourth king is Xerxes. It fits the two pieces of information that were given. And again, I'm sort of trying to go about this like we did with Isaiah 53. Let's just make a list of what we're given in the prophecy and try to figure out what that aligns to. So he gains more riches than his predecessors, and he's aggressive towards Greece. If you pair that with what's known about the succession of Persian kings, we end up at Xerxes. I've also read that some people would say that's the same king as the Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus of Esther. I'm not 100% clear on that. It does seem to fit the timeline, but we may be talking about the same ruler. Anybody have any insight or knowledge on that specifically? Artaxerxes. So this is, to me, this is just kind of a stopping point along the way through this prophecy. But there's not a whole lot of disagreement or skepticism about who these figures represent. Really, it's mostly whether or not it's God's word because it's so accurate. Let's continue on in our interpretation of this section of prophecy. So what we read in verse 3 is that there's another mighty king that arises. What are some details that you see that can help us identify this fifth mighty king?
It's more generous. His kingdom may be broken
Yeah, so again, we're hitting on kind of the traditional view here. It's generally thought that this is talking about Alexander the Great. He did rule for a short time. I think he was 34 when he died, fairly young king. He accomplished a lot in the few years that he was king. His kingdom ended up being divided into four pieces. It fits in terms of the timeline. It fits in terms of what we know historically about Alexander the Great. It's easy to just kind of go, okay, that's probably who this is talking about. Again, it's kind of a traditional view. He died in about 323 BC. So where does that put us on our timeline in Daniel? You know, I'm thinking we're a couple hundred years removed from when this vision is given to Daniel. A couple hundred years. You know, to us, we might think, well, that's a long time in the future. I wonder if Daniel felt that way. I wonder if at Daniel's age, seeing everything he had seen, seeing his nation be pulled into captivity, if 200 years feels like it's right around the corner. We can look back on it and have that perspective, obviously, because we're a couple of thousand years removed from these events, but sometimes I struggle to really get my head into Daniel's, so to speak, and think about what this would have meant to him and the emotions that would have come up in him as he's receiving this vision. Obviously, it was the right set of emotions to cause him to pray and fast for 3 weeks and really, really seek after some understanding. Okay, so we've got these four new kingdoms now. I'm going to keep reading in verse 9. We'll read another 8 or 9 verses or so. Oh, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. That passage already read got into the kings of the north and the south already. So let's continue on talking about the kings of the north and the south. Who are the kings of the north and the south? No idea, right? I had no idea. I'll be honest with you. I have a little bit of archaeological historical knowledge that overlaps with the Bible because I love it when that happens. I love it when there's an archaeological or historical connection directly into Scripture. That is just thrilling for me. But this is a period of the earth's history that I know almost nothing about. I have studied in preparation for this lesson more timelines than you really want to see this morning. And there are varying levels of detail. You can break this down by individual kings of these four countries that are split out from Alexander the Great's empire. The two that I think we need to concern ourselves with are Syria and Egypt. It seems like Syria and Egypt are the kings or the nations of the north and the south that are going to battle with each other. Again, this is kind of a traditional view. And I hope this isn't getting too dry at this point because we're trying to assign historical people to what's going on in this prophecy. But it kind of all builds to an amazing conclusion. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies are the royal successions and lines that are going to be battling with each other. They start this battling process in these first 8 verses of chapter 11. But it's really only getting started. This lines up really well, not only in terms of the timeline, not only in terms of what we know about the four kingdoms that split off of Alexander the Great, but if you look at a really, really detailed account of what the Ptolemies and the Seleucids actually did to one another and how their diplomacy interacted with each other, it fits really well with this description that we're going to continue reading. So continuing on in verse 9, then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. His sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war to his very fortress. The king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall. Yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. Then the king of the north will come, cast up a siege ramp, and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to run it, to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face towards the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. Lots and lots and lots of battling between the north and the south, between the Syrian and the Egyptian forces. Lots and lots of vivid details here about when one gets the upper hand and then the other one gets the upper hand. I don't know how detailed we really need to break that down, but it's clear to me that we're still in the right timeline for these two kingdoms, the kingdom of Syria and the kingdom of Egypt, the Seleucids versus the Ptolemies. It just goes on and on and on and on. And then you get down to verse 21. And in verse 21, the pace of this story changes. And we get out of what to me feels like almost a burdensome amount of back and forth detail to some vivid details about an individual. Instead of just the ongoing aggression between these two nations, we start to read about this one person. In verse 21, in his place, a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. What does your verse say there at the end of verse 21? Does anybody have a different word than intrigue?
Flattery.
Flattery? What else? I think I heard something else. Flattery? Okay. So this is not a person who is an heir to the throne. This is not a person who comes into his power honestly. By flattery and intrigue, he manages to seize control. Continuing in verse 22, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. We're seeing the same weapon still being used by this person. It's his ability to be shrewd and conniving and to use deception. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. This is a guy who takes advantage of the least path of least resistance. It says he comes in a time of tranquility, a time when he's not going to meet a lot of military resistance. And how does he do this? How does he seize control? How does he actually manipulate people? According to verse 24. What does that sound like to you? Pays him off? Yeah, to me it kind of sounds like bribery. He's distributing wealth. He's winning people's allegiance and winning their favor through bribery. Continuing in verse 25, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. This is the first of two sections here that we're going to read where this despicable person decides to turn his hatred and his aggression on the holy people, on God's people. And there's a distinction that's made here. It's almost like this is really what's in his heart. This is a personal thing for him. A lot of the other details we're given are business, maybe. Maybe business versus personal in our own vernacular. There's a financial or a political advantage to a lot of the scheming and the intrigue that this guy has been about. He's got something out for the holy people. Verse 29, at the appointed time he will return and come into the south. But this last time it will not turn out the way it did before, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the holy covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. For a second time, he's turning his aggressions on the holy people. And who does he show regard to? Anybody who, what does it say at the end of verse 30? Forsake the holy covenant. What's the saying? The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Continuing in verse 31, forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. We've read that before. So keep that in the back of your mind. We've read those exact words before, and at this point, we know exactly who this is. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Some very apocalyptic language there at the end that ties into some other studies we've done. There's an appointed time. Let's not forget, I'm up here reading this and boring you to death, but this is an angel that is saying this. This is an angel that has transferred this message to Daniel. This is the perspective of an angelic visitor. And Daniel is relating it for us. And from that visitor's perspective, all of this awful stuff has an appointed time. It has an ending. And that aligns with every other vision and message that we have studied in the book of Daniel so far. There's going to be a season of darkness, but it has an appointed end, because there's going to be justice for God's people. Okay, so who is this despicable person? Okay, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. I mentioned his name either class before last, maybe. He fits the profile perfectly. He wasn't an heir to royalty or to power. He was aggressive towards Egypt. He was a very skilled, shrewd political tactician and diplomat. He hated God's people. Specifically, the stopping of daily sacrifice, when he desecrated the holy temple and the holy altar by killing a swine and spreading oil and blood all over the place. Those are well-known stories about Antiochus Epiphanes if you're a student of the period between the Testaments. There are numerous extra-biblical sources that talk about that. It's not just scripture. That's a well-known thing that took place. Really, nobody disagrees that Antiochus Epiphanes was the one that did that. We've got a lot of hooks here that tie this to Antiochus the Fourth. Yeah. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. You know, I actually don't know where he, what his nationality was. Syrian. Okay, so he's one of the Syrians. Yeah, that's right. I did know that because Antiochus the First through the that was on the timeline that I had looked at trying to prepare for that period where the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are battling. But he is often thought to be the little horn, and I'm not going to derail us by talking about the little horn this morning. You guys have already put up with enough of that. But he's thought by some in the interpretations of the beast visions in Daniel and Revelation to be the figure that is the little horn. The one that speaks blasphemies and causes all this trouble for God's people. So that fits the profile. Yes?
Where does this fit in the timeline referring to Jesus in Matthew 24:15? Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let them understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains and the destruction of Jerusalem. I understand what Jesus is talking about here.
Yep. Go ahead.
I could be wrong. I've not studied Matthew 24 as much as many people, but I think the abomination of desolation here in Daniel is specifically talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, but the desolation is the desolation of sacrifice in the temple.
Yeah.
And in Matthew 24, I think what Jesus is referring to is, again, the point in time when sacrifices will cease in the temple, which I think most of us would agree is looking forward towards the destruction of the temple.
Yeah, I would just add to that, that's thank you for summarizing that. I think that there's multiple times where the abomination of desolation applies to what takes place. And I'm with you. I've always understood Matthew 24 to be talking about the future destruction of Jerusalem, the AD 70 destruction. That's a great, I appreciate the similarity that you drew there between two different times where those sacrifices won't be possible anymore. In one case, you've got this despicable person who's preventing it. In the other case, you've got the destruction of Jerusalem. Not necessarily referring to the exact same instance yet. I want to give a few more details here, there's question in my mind as to who this is talking about, and this gets a little graphic, but I don't think we really grasp sometimes how terrible this was. To understand how terrible Antiochus Epiphanes was, you have to go outside of Daniel, you have to go outside the Bible, and you have to read the accounts of the Maccabees, you have to read some of Josephus, and you have to read what just regular people had to say about it. He was executing mothers who circumcised their children. He was executing and making public display of males who had been circumcised. He was defiling altars and homes. There were home invasions and sanctuary invasions with terrible practices. He built a pagan altar right on top of the Lord's altar so that he could do pagan things on top of it. All of the books of the covenant were torn apart or burned at one point by Antiochus Epiphanes. Every copy that he could get a hold of, he destroyed. Anybody who was found to be in possession of a copy of the holy writings was executed. Anybody who was found to be sympathetic towards anybody who had a copy of the holy, it just went on and on and on. It's a kind of political, religious persecution that nobody here today, I think, has ever experienced in our nation, thankfully. Patrick?
Do you know where
it is? I actually don't. I wish that was a part of the story that I had access to. It tells us in the passage here that his heart was against the holy people. I don't know if there was a personal experience he had in his life that made him hate Jews or hate God. But he's a force that's being used in the story that's being told here, and certainly he has an allotted time by the Creator. Okay. In meaning that when the temple was destroyed in AD 70, the people and the Christians or the God-fearing people in Jerusalem who were fleeing would have been under the same amount of duress.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just remember, the Old Testament is a shadow of things to come. So this is what he's talking about, a terrible situation that happened. Short time for them and long time for Christians.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I have about 5 minutes left, and I want to move on to verse 36, finishing out this chapter. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will cause them to rule over many and will parcel out land for a price. At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape, but he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him." Very quickly here, there's less agreement on this section. This is the part of the chapter I mentioned at the beginning. There's general agreement all the way up to this point. And so the question is, who is this talking about? I'm sort of in the camp that thinks that in verse 36, where it says, "then the king," we've transitioned away from Antiochus the IV. And part of the argument in favor of that transition is that everything I just read doesn't really work. It doesn't really talk about Antiochus. He didn't do a lot of those things. So in a sense, it can't really be talking about Antiochus the way I think about it. That's just my left brain, logical, you know, this can't be the same person. But some of you may be a better student of this already than I am, and I'd love to hear your perspective on that if you disagree. But some believe that this ties to the Antichrist of Revelation. In order to make that connection, you'll have already made some premillennial interpretations along the way as we've studied Daniel and Revelation that differ from the conclusions that I've tried to draw in this class. So that's also not my view. The view that I think has the most going for it is that this could be the Roman Empire yet again. There are multiple times in this class where we've gotten to this all-powerful character in the story. In the narrative framework of some of these apocalyptic writings that we've studied, we get to this point where somebody comes, a nation, a king, like none that has ever been seen before. The beast, right? The feet mixed with clay and iron. There are very, very specific indicators that this is a kingdom like nobody else. There's a lot going for this view. Exalts himself above every god, blasphemes the God of gods, clashes with Syria and Egypt. Who did Rome not clash with? Enters and conquers the Holy Land. There's an event that takes place with one of the Roman generals, I believe in the 2nd century, where they sweep in and they conquest a large part of the region, but these same three nations, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, are able to escape. It's kind of a shaky connection, but I thought it was interesting. Defeats and plunders Egypt, occupation of the Holy Land. There's a lot going for that view, but it's not ironclad, and that's why there's a little bit of disagreement over who this section is talking about. I just want to leave you with this. This is just sort of an interpretive summary of chapter 11 as Kurt sees it, for whatever that's worth. But we've got Xerxes, the fourth king. We've got Alexander the Great. He's the mighty king that arises afterwards. He has a very brief rule. We've got the three kingdoms that split off from him. The kings of the north and the south, the battling Egyptians and Syrians. Antiochus the IV, the despicable person of that section. And then Roman forces in Egypt. I didn't really get to talk about that too much, but we kind of build to a conclusion that this last section is talking about the Romans. That section there in verse 30 and 31 is really interesting, the ships of Kittim. I had to look that one up. Kittim is used a couple of different places in Scripture, and I actually had to look at something in Josephus to really understand this. According to Josephus, who wrote a lot about the Hebrews in the time periods before Christ and afterward, Kittim was a phrase that the Hebrews would use for the islands and the coastlands to the west. It's known that Roman ships came and parked, basically, and actually repelled Antiochus the second time he came down to Egypt. The first time he came down to make trouble, it went okay. The second time, as this passage we read a few minutes ago says, it didn't go the same way. It didn't go the way it did the first time. And that's partly because Rome was there, and they just said, "Get out of here. We're not going to put up with you." So there's a lot of tie-ins there to Rome during the last third of this chapter. Next week, we're going to continue this section of Daniel. We're going to read chapter 12, and we're going to finish up the book. It's a tough chapter. It's tough to listen to me run through that as fast as I did, and I apologize for the pace of this class today, but I appreciate your attention and your comments. Apologize for the gaps in my own knowledge. I appreciate your helping me fill them. I hope it was helpful, and I hope that, like Isaiah 53, you can now look back at Daniel 11, not as this monotonous list of details, but as one of the most accurate prophecies in Scripture that gave Daniel a sense of hope in an upcoming hopeless time. Thanks for your participation this morning.